I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Hello and welcome to Material Girls, a pop culture podcast that uses critical theory to understand the zeitgeist. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman. And this week, we have an extremely fancy guest. Anne Helen Peterson, pronouns she, her, is a writer and journalist and recovering academic. She writes a fabulous newsletter called Culture Study and is the host of a brand new podcast of the same name. She's also the author of 4 books. Most recently, Out of the Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home, co-written with Charlie Warzel, and Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Welcome, Anne.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
What a delight. So we're having a larger conversation today about athleisure, which I'm very excited about, because I live in Vancouver, which is the city that is sponsored by athleisure.
And also, I can like look out my window and see you because, you know, I'm right over the border. So yeah, I'm waving to you.
Can you?
Yeah, Lummi Island. Like I can see Canada, like the Canadian Rockies. Aww. Yeah, yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Look at you too.
Yeah, but also I'm wearing, most days, today I am not wearing athleisure. Most days I am wearing athleisure.
Just head to toe athleisure. Well, speaking of what we're wearing today, I thought maybe we could start off by talking about what we're wearing and whether, to steal one of your popular phrases, Anne, whether any of our outfits are rich text.
Okay, so I had a thing that I had to appear on camera and be professional earlier today. So I am wearing mascara. Like my mom was over earlier today and she's like, why do your eyelashes look weird? I was like, Mom, shut up.
Thanks, Mom.
And so I'm wearing that. And then I am wearing my big splurge sweater of the year. Every year I like get one nice new sweater and it's from Cézanne, which has my number. Cézanne is like a French sweater company that is always like, oh, don't you want to be a very fashionable French lady who wears sweaters that last until they're 80? And you're like, yes, that's me. That's me. That is who I am. Please let me buy one of your sweaters. And the good news is that I have actually worn it like probably twice a week ever since buying it. So I love it. But it was sort of ruined for me after I did a podcast with Amanda Mull about sweaters and why clothes are so crappy. And I was like, oh, surely my sweater has no plastic in it, right? My fancy French sweater. And then I went and looked at the tag and there was, of course, some plastic in it. But that's what I'm wearing.
I mean, I'm dressed in, other than this cotton button down, I am dressed in head to toe plastic, which is to say I'm wearing like leggings and a sports bra. Nary a natural fiber to be found between the two of them. I was telling Coach before y'all arrived that in addition to recording this episode, I am also recording an episode later today of another one of our shows, Making Worlds, about Tasman Weir's Locked Tomb Trilogy, which is about necromancers. And so this is my goth athleisure look that I have crafted to sort of cross the boundaries between these two aesthetics.
It works.
And Marcel?
I am wearing a combination of purple athleisure. I'm wearing a cropped purple sweatshirt from the Truly Evil Gap.
The Truly Evil.
Although maybe this one was a Gap for Good purchase. Hard to say. We should definitely do an episode about like social justice washing.
Yeah.
My purple leggings are from Snag, where I, honest to goodness, buy the majority of the things that I wear for comfort. Bras, underwear, tights, pantyhose. I hear they're going to come out with jeans soon. And you know what? I will be there.
Wear the heck out of those.
I will be there.
Thank you, Snag, for dressing me head to toe. Again, in plastic, but yeah. It feels so good.
This episode brought to you by Snag.
And plastic.
Okay, Anne, get ready, because these segment intros are just for you. We're starting off with Why This, Why Now, wherein we ask the materialist question, what are or were the historical, ideological, and material conditions for our object of study to become zeitgeisty?
And of course, today we're talking about the rise of athleisure. And Anne, you suggested this topic, and it's taken me down some delightful research rabbit holes, mostly about how much I hate Chip Wilson. But before I double down on my trademark, Miss Andrea, can you tell us what drew you to talking about athleisure? Why is this a topic that fascinates you?
Oh, I just think like the way that we like convey our readiness to like be casual and exercise and always ready to exercise, like all of that is just so fascinating and also not new, right? Like casual wear itself has this long lineage that, you know, I only know the larger vague parts of that I'm so excited for you to teach me about. But like, I think back on like white corded sweaters with like V-necks and stuff like that, that rich people would wear to play tennis. Like that to me, that's the antecedent, right? Like there are these ways that we have performed the ease with which we can do leisure at any moment, but then also how you have to like do it in a certain way so as not to suggest that you are unkempt, right? There's like such a line between sweatpants and leggings, and like where do joggers come in? And so I think that like our current moment where you have all of these different variations of athleisure, and also like the whole entire segment of athleisure that's like, here's the athleisure you wear on a date. Like here's your like formal athleisure, like recreating this category, is all fascinating to me. So yeah.
100%. There's so much class involved in it. I mean, talking about these histories, I immediately started thinking about the like rich horse girl.
Yeah.
And like the long history of like wearing jodhpurs and an oversized sweater and that being like the fanciest thing you can wear because it suggests that you own horses.
Right, right.
And then also the like racialized histories of athleisure, right? Like the way that you can wear forms of athleisure in professional environments if they come out of white culture. Mm-hmm. But like hip hop culture has been wearing forms of athleisure for decades, and that is like explicitly not allowed in a lot of like professional or fancy spaces. So it's tied in with a lot of complex histories. So I am going to sketch a little bit of that history for us in this segment. And the history that I'm going to focus on starts in post-World War II America with the sales challenge that textile companies like DuPont were facing as they were trying to create markets for the cool new fabrics that they invented during the war. They're like, cool, we've got these like really neat new stretchy plastic-based textiles. How do we convince people to buy them? And because women were emerging in the same historical period as both the primary buyers of household goods and a rapidly growing demographic for the fashion industry. A lot of the new marketing for these artificial textiles like polyester and spandex really focused on women, of course. So I read a profoundly entertaining article by Kaori O'Connor about the history of Lycra, which is DuPont's trademarked name for spandex. I also found out what the difference between spandex and Lycra is. None. None. It's just Kleenex and tissue.
Yep.
Now I know. And the crisis that DuPont was facing about the disappearance of the girdle.
Oh, no.
Because that was their big sales point. They were like, Lycra makes a really comfortable girdle. But then meanwhile, women were like, maybe we don't want to wear girdles anymore. And DuPont was like, fuck, we were really counting on you wearing girdles.
They were like, like, oh, just wait 50 years and we'll reinvent the girdle.
We're going to call it shapewear. So, Marcel, I wonder if you could read a little excerpt from this article for me.
Oh, truly, it would be my pleasure. Quote, having wrestled for more than 20 years with the problems of stress decay, tensile strength, color fastness, and resistance to degradation by gases, solvents, and lights. Having undertaken extensive market research to establish the existence of a consumer market for lighter girdles, having created Lycra for this market and having spent $10 million on research and development, DuPont now found that the market for girdles was fast disappearing for reasons that had nothing to do with the technological capabilities of the product and everything to do with a change in culture that it did not understand, end quote.
Fabulous. Thank you. So would either of you like to theorize what was happening in the 60s and 70s that led to a declining girdle market?
Feminism. Martians? Hippies. Martians, feminism, hippies, all three,
yep.
Right? Like all together.
Yep.
Yeah, it was just, yep. just seismic culture change in the way that like we thought about dressing.
Yeah, 100%. And maybe any theories about what new use of spandex stepped into the void left by girdles?
Exercise wear. You know, they're like, da, da, da,
yeah. Da, da, yeah, 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 yeah. The rise of aerobics.
Aerobics, that's
clothing,
the word
right?
I was looking for.
The 70s in particular, we get the emergence of like aerobics wear, like the image of flash dance aesthetic.
Jane Fonda.
Yes, Jane Fonda, exactly. So O'Connor theorizes this shift from girdles to aerobics wear as a shift in the locus of control for women's bodies. Mm. So she basically says the girdle represented an external and socially dictated control of women's bodies that like restricted movement and your ability to breathe. Whereas aerobics, on the other hand, encouraged movement and mobility and displayed rather than disguising the body.
Mm.
And so it became this sort of internalized mode of disciplining the body, which is that you produced a body that looked good in aerobics wear rather than disciplining a body via the application of a girdle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, it's all like Jane Fonda though too, right? Like it's like Jane Fonda transitioning from like this like unruly woman over the course of the 1960s and 70s. And then it's like, oh, and now I'm going to marry Ted Turner and I'm going to do aerobics all the time, right? Like real shift in feminism too.
Mm.
Yes. Yes. No, 100%. And like a kind of emergent consumer feminism, which is not a coincidence because we actively see these corporations figuring out how to reshape political movements via consumerism.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back to this relationship between active wear and bodily display and the notion of women's bodily management in the next segment. But for now, let's keep tracking the history.
I just want to confirm, like, athleisure isn't the same, like what I'm wearing right now is not the same thing as 70s and 80s aerobic exercise clothing, right?
Yeah, I think there's a really different history and I think there's some key differences. And one of those is the shift from athletic wear being a specialized uniform intended for really specific activities to what we're seeing now, which is its saturation across women's fashion, across different demographics, across different social contexts. The leisure added to the af.
Yeah, right. Because like before it was like, oh, there's sweatpants, stuff that like looser fabric, things that were more casual in that capacity. Like I think that the caftan was actually the better antecedent for athleisure in like the 70s.
I love that. There was also a moment, I think also in the 70s, where like ballet fashion got really big.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a moment of like crossover from a specialized sports uniform into streetwear for women.
Like a big sweatshirt and leggings, as long as you had the like slouchy socks.
Right. And that's very 80s, right? And it's like the bum equipment sweatshirt.
Mm-hmm.
Very aspirational. Or a spree.
Yeah, oh my God, a spree.
Oh, a spree.
You just say that word and women of a certain age will
just have to lie down.
Yes.
But the particular version of athleisure that we were talking about, sort of the contemporary incarnation, the one that's obsessed with bodily discipline and that concept of being like always ready to do a sport, that really comes along with the rise of Lululemon.
So let's dunk on Chip Wilson, right?
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, it's time. It's time. Boy, I hate this guy. You know why I hate Chip Wilson? I hate Chip Wilson because he is the richest man in Vancouver. He owns the most expensive house in Vancouver, and he uses his money to back conservative political candidates.
Mm.
Chip Wilson has actively got a mayor voted in who is like campaigned on the promise of more policing.
Mm.
Chip Wilson sucks. But also, he's also super fat phobic. So at least we've got that. So Chip Wilson, in 1998, he founded Lululemon. Apparently, after attending a yoga class and noticing how good women's butts looked in yoga pants. Maybe apocryphal, but that's the story he tells. So, cool. Also, he says that he named it Lululemon because Japanese people struggle with pronouncing the letter L, and he thought that was funny.
Cool.
Cool guy.
What a cool guy.
Way to go, Chip.
Love this guy.
Anyway, I have this longish quote from him describing the founding of the company that I think is really illustrative. And Anne, I'm wondering if you would mind reading this longest Chip Wilson monologue.
Quote, "I came from the world of technical snowboarding apparel where clothes had to function under extreme life or death conditions, and they had to be flexible enough to use in different settings. When the surf's up or the snow dumps, there's no time to change from street clothes to sports gear and back again. My first company catered to this nascent market. But like most athletic companies at the time, we didn't pay proper attention to the neglected women's market. Lululemon was the first company of its kind to focus on a growing market of highly educated, well-traveled athletic women. We made clothing to be functional first and foremost. And in the functional placement of elements like seams and zippers, we created new and beautiful styles. The clothes could easily go from the gym to the street because the fabrics wicked sweat and didn't stink. Side note, that's not true. And the styles were fresh and flattering. Our focus on performance pushed us to innovate." End quote.
Thank you. Now tell me, professional close readers of media, what do you make of Chip Wilson's framing of the dawn of Lululemon?
He's just like so much hubris. He's like, no one has ever made athletic gear for women before, which is just not true.
And the women who wear Lululemon are smart and savvy and cosmopolitan, and they travel.
Yes.
They're well-educated.
Well-educated is the real dig, right? You know, it's like, if you're smart, then you want Lululemon. I also like, and we can get at this a little bit more, but I think the framing of like, we made the clothing to be functional first and foremost is so counter to how I now think of Lululemon's style. Like, it makes sense, I think, maybe foundationally, that what they were really thinking of was this crossover utility of being able to like still wear the thing that you exercised in and not look ridiculous in a public space.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that that discounts too how they pushed the market, right? Like, part of the reason it doesn't feel ridiculous in a public space is through the way that they saturated the market. And also, and he doesn't mention this, like used pretty classic merchandising tactics to create a demand for all different colors, right? Like an overconsumption of Lululemon that helped in turn make it ubiquitous and created the market for knockoffs as well.
Yeah, and this emphasis that he has on the idea that they're functional first and that they are for functional bodies.
Yeah.
Mm.
Also, like, reminds us of this really fraught relationship between form and function that we see throughout conversations about athleisure, which is
you know, it is an aesthetic, but it's an aesthetic that is being framed here really explicitly as being first and foremost about function, and thus as like demonstrating to people something real and true about you and your body.
Yeah. Mm. And also like that there's a certain type of person that he thinks should be in those clothes, right? And by...
Yeah.
He doesn't mention it, but that also means that there's a certain type of person, a certain type of body that he doesn't want in those clothes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he does mention it in the next quote that I'm going to give you from him.
Oh, I'm so excited.
So in the same piece, which was published in Forbes in 2018, Wilson distinguishes between athleisure, which he insists Lululemon is not. He says athleisure is non-technical fast fashion that is just stealing the aesthetics of companies like his.
Mm-hmm.
And the term he prefers for his own company's designs is street technical or streetnik.
Streetnik.
No.
Streetnik didn't catch on. But
no.
That emphasis on the relationship between clothes and the bodies that wear the clothes went from subtext to text, let's say, mm-hmm. in 2013, when that was the year when a bunch of Lululemon yoga pants were being recalled for being see-through.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quoted in an interview as saying that, quote, some women's bodies just don't work, end quote, for Lululemon clothes.
What a piece of shit.
So isn't that fascinating to think about this, like, some women's bodies just don't work? Mm-hmm. For these clothes, which is obviously fat phobia, but mm-hmm. is framed in such a very particular way.
Right. And also that like the fault is the body, not the clothes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a broken body, not a broken piece of clothing.
Yeah. His garments are perfect.
Yes.
For the bodies that they were made for.
Yes.
That's right.
And they were made for very particular bodies.
Yeah.
So again, we've got this idea that athleisure is displaying a body that is being worked on. And demands a body that is already the product of that work. Mm-hmm. So it both demonstrates that you are participating in a particular kind of physical layups, sort of working on your body towards, I'm going to give away the next section, but towards optimizing it.
Oh, that's in the title of this episode.
Oh, it's in the title of the episode. And yeah, again, demanding that the body already be optimized in order for the clothes to work on you.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think the best theorizer of athleisure and its relationship to bodily expectations is Gia Tolentino, who writes really brilliantly on the subject. And she has this wonderful profile of Outdoor Voices, which is, you know, another trendy athleisure company
mm-hmm.
that she wrote for The New Yorker, where she argues that athleisure is perfectly suited to, quote, an era in which for many women, improving their looks and their lifestyle has become a job they're supposed to regard as fun, end quote.
Yeah.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
Are we all having a great time?
Athleisure. It's so comfortable. Feels so good.
I'm having so much fun right now in these high-waisted leggings.
Oh my God. I love constantly working on my body. It's so good. She has another longer piece on athleisure in Trick Mirror where she talks, it's called Athleisure, Bar and Kale, The Tyranny of the Ideal Woman. And Anne, I'm gonna throw this back to you and ask you to read us a little Tolentino excerpt to segue us into our next segment.
Quote, this is how athleisure has carved out the space between exercise apparel and fashion. The former category optimizes your performance, the latter optimizes your appearance, and athleisure does both simultaneously. It is tailor-made for a time when work is rebranded as pleasure so that we will accept more of it. A time when, for women, improving your looks is a job that you're supposed to believe is fun. And the real trick of athleisure is the way it can physically suggest that you were made to do this, that you're the kind of person who thinks that putting in expensive hard work for a high-functioning, maximally attractive consumer existence is about as good a way to pass your time on Earth as there is. End quote.
Oh, man, I cannot wait to dig into the theory about this because we got to talk about optimization.
Yeah.
We just got to.
You know what, Marcel?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to. It's another segment. This one is called The Theory We Need, and it's the segment where we introduce some critical theory to help make sense of our topic. Now, we're not going to be focusing on a particular theorist today, but rather on a theoretical concept in this segment. But some of you are going to detect a heavy sprinkle of Foucault underpinning a lot of what we're going to be saying about practices of disciplining the body. And if that's you, just know that you're right, and I'm very proud of you.
Hannah,
Are you proud of me?
I'm especially proud of you.
Thank you.
And I would be very proud of both of you if you told me a bit about your understanding of optimization.
You want to go first?
And that sigh spoke volumes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it, like, for me, it all is part of this. I mean, if we're thinking in like Foucauldian terms, like this self-surveillance, like you have turned the gaze of capitalism on yourself to try to make yourself into a more productive body in all ways, right? And not in the service of like happiness or fulfillment. It's more in the service of like, how can I wring more labor out of myself, right? And so like everything leads back to how do I make myself a more producing body within this scheme of capitalism. So even something like exercise is primarily framed as a means of regimenting your body so as to be a better citizen within capitalism. So like the example I always think of is like you should meditate not to like find inner peace or equilibrium or like explore the self, but so that you can work more efficiently, right? Like that is optimization culture in a nutshell to me.
Yeah.
God, that is perfect.
I'm currently reading Jenny O'Dell's second book.
Saving Time.
Yeah. And she talks about these 19th century like work optimization manuals that are like, when you are taking the train to work in the morning, do not read or look out the window because that uses up valuable brain function time. Instead, stare into the middle distance, which is functionally the same as sleep.
But that, you know, that's so funny because it's actually a counter understanding to, I think, how we think about optimization culture now, because then they were trying to preserve themselves for the unique period of time that was dedicated to work. And now, because work has spread into every corner of our lives, you must always be multitasking. So while you're on the train, you absolutely have to be listening to a podcast and using your brain capacity. But then when you get to work, which lasts all day, you must also be optimizing yourself to run at full capacity then too with all of your different gadgets and email hacks and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the best thing you can do to be maximally optimized is to wake up at 5 a.m. and do a two-hour workout before you get ready for work because that will create a more optimized body.
Absolutely.
This is exhausting. Just this conversation is making me so tired and I would like to go and take a nap.
No time, Marcel. You have labor to do.
No, my body does not labor.
So Tolentino, in the same piece about athleisure, links optimization back to 19th century economic theory. And she quotes William Stanley Jevons, author of The Theory of Political Economy, who describes optimization as the drive, quote, to satisfy our wants to the utmost with the least effort, to procure the greatest amount of what is desirable at the expense of the least that is undesirable. In other words, to maximize pleasure, end quote.
I don't know about this maximizing pleasure business based on what the two of you have been describing. It sounds like it's an economic term that is being abused. And well, I mean, economics is already a form of abuse, but it's being misapplied to individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's taking sort of an idea about optimizing the way society runs so that we can do the least possible labor and have the greatest possible amount of pleasure to instead relocating the locus of optimization to the individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also crucial for us to understand that in the 19th century, there was this idea that like leisure mattered, right? That like you could still preserve leisure and that people had a right to leisure. And a lot of this intersected with like the labor movement, right? Which understood leisure as part, like, so the idea, especially amongst more liberal economists, that like, as we can get better and better at things, then we can work less and less, transformed into, as we get better and better at things, then we can work more.
And we can do more.
You could be always working.
You can always work.
And if you do what you love, then you never work a day in your life. And so you'll want to.
Okay, you'll constantly always be working, never resting. And always think of any leisure activity as bad and wrong in some way.
A waste of time.
100%, unless it's productive.
That was academia that taught me that, but I'm sure other forces taught me it as well.
Man, the way academia breaks your brain. My supervisor once told me that hobbies were a sign of weakness of mind.
We had a phrase. My best friend and I was like, everything that is bad is good and everything that is good is bad. So like if you're doing something you like, it's bad. You should be working more, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
That's how you know. That's how, because if you listen to what your animal body enjoyed, that's a sign you're not an intellectual.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No pleasure for any of us. So I want to incorporate another perspective here just because I don't want us to have a totally one-dimensional portrait of the history of optimization. So mm-hmm. I found an interesting article by these two sociologists, Daniel Nehring and Anya Rucka, who traced some alternate histories of optimization, particularly self-optimization. And they note that the term's use becomes much more widespread in the mid-1950s with the invention of mathematical programming. Don't ask me what that is. I didn't look it up. I have no way to answer any of your questions.
I think it's just programming. It's just programming. It's not like those little cards. Like you're not using the cards
to
program the computer.
The movement away from the cards.
Yeah.
And then the discourse of optimization increases even further, quote, in relation to cybernetic ideas of self-regulating and self-controlling systems, end quote. So again, we're talking here about systems rather than individuals. That's economics in one case and computer systems in the other. So again, these earlier histories of optimization are thinking about us as like social beings who are part of systems that like relate to each other. And like that is pretty fundamentally divorced from what neoliberalism does to the concept of optimization. So arguably, optimization is what we get when we take self-improvement and throw it into a blender with tech culture and neoliberalism. And Marcel, mm-hmm. I know that you're really well-versed in this. So could you just quickly remind people of what neoliberalism is?
You're such a liar. So here's what I believe in my heart that I know about neoliberalism. It is the dominant ideology of our time. It is the logic of the free market, the so-called free market, and it has been turned and applied to the individual. And so we use the language of neoliberalism, which is an economic term, to explain things like human interaction and the quality of life. And so this is why we can think about doing exercise, which maybe one time we might have thought of as a way to like move our bodies in a way that is fun and feels good. And instead, we think about it in terms of maximizing our productivity. Is that right?
Also personal responsibility when it comes to like health, right? So like the person responsible for your health is you and you alone.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And you have a responsibility to maintain your health for the good of society.
Yes. And if you don't, you're bad.
That's right. Yeah. If you get sick, you are a burden on the system.
100%. And that's what like the neoliberal discourse of like fat people are a burden on the medical system.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, a fundamentally eugenicist idea, but is rooted in this idea of like profound individual responsibility, which then in turn needs to imagine our bodies and minds as infinitely plastic, infinitely reshapable via these optimizing activities, right? That's why tech bros love biohacking so much, because it's built in this fantasy of the body as perfectly plastic and potentially perfectible if you just work hard enough on it.
Yeah.
Is that why like tech startups would have cereal bars? Like, maybe this is apocryphal, but I feel like I heard about this, that like you join a tech startup and you don't get benefits, but you do get a cereal bar. So when you show up, you can like have breakfast while you go to your computer and do your tech work.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, when I worked at BuzzFeed, not only did we have a cornucopia of cereal bars, but also like the mini yogurts, right? That had just like a little bit of granola on top.
Yeah.
But then we also had all sorts of other snacks that were meant to make it so that you would never leave the building. And like catered lunch is not about like you saving money on lunch. It's about you
working through lunch,
eating your sad desk lunch, right? Like it's about productivity.
100%. And like, you know, again, these built-in spaces for leisure, right? You hear the like, oh, the tech startup always has like a ping pong table or like.
We had a ping pong table. And a froyo machine that changed flavors every week. Can you imagine me going from academia to that? That was what I did. The whiplash.
Did you feel like an anthropologist?
Yes. And also, even though tech companies are so renowned for, you know, bad work-life balance, all that sort of thing, it was so much better than academia. I was like, I'm working so much less. What's a Sunday?
Like, as you're describing this, there is a little part of me that's like, I know it's wrong, but I would love it if they provided me with breakfast when I got to work.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm already eating at my desk, but I had to bring my lunch from home.
But, you know, I think actually the comparison and like how academia gets like on the spectrum is a great example of how neoliberalism has invaded the academy, right?
Absolutely.
So like within the academy is the responsible of the individual and to work the way that they do in order to fund their own position, improve their own position, all that sort of thing.
100%. Yeah. So neoliberalism and optimization, as we can tell, are best friends because they're all about productivity and deregulation and individualization and the disintegration of the social safety net in favor of self-sufficiency, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, they're both tied into notions of productivity, the idea that time itself is something that can be used more or less productively, that our days are units of potential productivity, and a failure to optimize our productivity is a failure to use our time properly. 1,000 shout outs to Jenny Odell, obviously. So built into the premise of dressing in athleisure is the idea of a maximally productive outfit.
With the rise of work from home, are we seeing an increase in the use of athleisure as workwear?
Yes. Well, you know, it's ubiquitous all across social media, especially as like there was a transition of moving more like sometimes in the office, right? Was like, I don't know what like hard pants are, right? Like the difference between soft and hard pants. Like soft pants are athleisure because they're not necessarily leggings. They are soft pants, unrestricted pants. I think most fashion scholars would probably say that this is an ongoing shift in the casualization of office wear, right? That we've been seeing for the last 50 years, probably. Like, you know, if we're going back to like the shift in using these fabrics that didn't have to be ironed as much. Mm-hmm. Like that's part of this larger shift over the course of the 50s and 60s and 70s. And even the idea that like women don't have to wear pantyhose with exposed legs, right? That's part of this too. And men in ties and that sort of thing.
I got this and from your podcast, but also that these fabrics make a lot more sense in a fashion market in which tailoring's not a thing for the most part anymore. And so stretchy fabrics fit a wider range of bodies, you have greater faith that you can like buy something online and like probably it's going to fit you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also I think Lululemon is the exception in terms of it's still sizing in numbers, but most athleisure brands size more like small, extra small, large, extra large, that sort of thing, right? So you have the larger bucket, for lack of a better term, in which a person can size themselves. And that creates fewer chances for poor fits, right? Like there's less loss in that sort of system. Whereas with something like jeans, where you have not only the waist, but also the length to consider, like there's just, it's a harder fit. And what I think these companies want more than anything is for people to buy things and then keep them.
Yeah. So it's also an optimization of the fashion industry itself.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. There's one last set of theorists I want to bring in. We've touched on some of the points that they make already, but I want to cite them explicitly. And this is feminist scholars Julie Bryce and Holly Thorpe, who have written quite a bit about athleisure. And they describe it as, quote, the uniform of the neoliberal female citizen, end quote. And they link it in particular to the neoliberal reframing of health as a purely individual rather than collective and social and structural concern. So alongside the neoliberal privatization of healthcare and other public institutions that might promote health, instead we get this idea that health is about individual choices and behaviors, and that failing to participate in said behaviors is a moral and social failing. So athleisure becomes the outward marker of a properly self-disciplined body, and by extension, of an appropriately behaved citizen who's managing themselves properly so as not to prove a burden to the rest of society, which is the argument that they are making by calling it, again, the uniform of the neoliberal female citizen. And the business practices of the companies that sell athleisure are in turn designed to encourage this understanding of consumption as self-optimization.
Hannah?
Yes, Marcel?
You're giving away your thesis before thesis time.
Well, then I guess it's time for our next segment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
All right, final segment. In this one, we get to watch Hannah bring together the history of our object of study and our theoretical framework to articulate a thesis statement that we then get to pick apart.
Oh, can't wait. Athleisure is a global industry that is already worth over $350 billion and is forecast to double in size over the next decade. This growing market segment can be linked to various things: the invention of new high-performance fabrics that are more comfortable than the more structured fabrics of the past, a shift in dress culture that allows for more casual clothing in professional environments, but ultimately, athleisure is indivisible from the neoliberal culture of self-optimization, in which each individual is expected to be a maximally productive and self-disciplined subject. The social and moral demand towards self-optimization finds its clearest expression in the well-managed body, a body that serves as an outward assurance that this good neoliberal citizen will only contribute to and never demand anything from society. In this essay,
Wait. I feel like this is slightly too negative about athleisure.
Whoa.
Like, I think you're like too down on athleisure, because the thing is that I agree with you about everything that is wrong with the ethos, the underpinning of Lululemon, which we have to be clear, he has sold the company. He is no longer affiliated with the company, even though he still makes statements as if he were still affiliated with the company. Mm-hmm. And you can't wash that toxicity out.
I think he still owns a bunch of shares. I think he just doesn't have, he doesn't have the controlling share in the company, yeah. But he's still profiting off it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, to be clear. But there are so many other companies that are doing a lot with athleisure, right? That are like expanding the size to make actually comfortable and cute clothing to work out if you are in a larger body, which has not been available for a really long time. They have done so much to create much better, I think, maternity wear, right? Like wear stuff that is much more comfortable and for the long term while you're breastfeeding or have a body that's in transition from different shapes, right? And I think that like it's also kind of cool to have like different options when you're just getting boobs too. You know, like something like a sports bra is a great transition from like when you're about a tween into a teen. Like there's just something that like, but maybe that too is like, oh, you're optimizing tweens. But I was wearing Umbros and like soccer shoes. I didn't play soccer. That was just what was cool. Like I was still incorporating these parts of sports culture into my wardrobe at that time. So I think I just want to be ambivalent a little bit.
Then you've come to the right place.
You know what we haven't talked about yet?
What?
We haven't talked about the range of color options that are available in athleisure that you just don't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, you go into Goodwill and you go to the athleisure section and it is a cornucopia of neon. And I, for one, I'm here for it.
Yes. Yeah.
And some of the stuff, not all athleisure is created equal, but some actually does last a long time, right? And to have high quality clothes that you can wear for a long time, that's great, right?
Mm-hmm. Optimized fabrics.
I do have a tip, though, for anyone who wants to know how to get the smell out of their athleisure.
Oh, yeah.
We can save that for the Patreon, though, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love that claim about the clothes don't stink, which is like, yeah, they do, Doug.
For sure. They totally do.
You do
you
hot,
just can't smell
you do
it
hot
anymore,
yoga
Chip.
And you're not going to work after that.
No. Oh my God. Well, especially if you're like me and you did hot yoga like multiple days with the same yoga pants.
Oh man.
Because you didn't have a washer dryer in your building because you were a poor graduate student who could only go to hot yoga because they had a poor graduate student, right?
I also did hot yoga through my PhD because I had a poor graduate student, right?
Yeah.
And the way that your second day sweat sort of reactivates the day one sweat.
It's so real. Like at day three or four, it's just like crusty, you know, like your pants could stand up by themselves.
You guys are so gross.
I didn't have a washer dryer.
When I sweat, it smells like flowers.
I smell
lilacs specifically.
It smells like
it's a pleasure to be around me in hot yoga. Yeah.
To go back to your intervention, Anne, I wear a lot of athleisure. And ironically, part of the pleasure of it for me is that plus size athleisure is about the celebratory display of a body that is very specifically not optimized. Like when I wear athleisure, when I wear like, you know, some high-waisted yoga pants and you can just see my belly, I feel like I'm like given like flipping the double birds to Chip Wilson. Like, oh, he'd be so mad. And that makes me feel great.
Mm-hmm.
And athleisure, like the colorways, like Marcel said, like athleisure gets very gay. It gets like really over the top, clownish at times.
Mm-hmm.
In Vancouver, people wear black athleisure. It's all black. It's all just, nobody wears anything other than black. But that's Vancouver's fault, not athleisure's fault.
And there's so many like impossible sports bras, like with like weird straps in places where they don't need to be. There's design stuff that's kind of playful, and I appreciate that.
I guess what this is sort of making me think about is, and forgive me, I know that we've done multiple episodes about this, or multiple episodes that bring in this complication, and I simply cannot remember any of them. But there's the way that things are designed and the intended market, and then there's the way that people use them, and there is often a major disconnect between those two things. And so while the intention behind athleisure may have been only certain bodies in certain ways to promote a certain kind of culture, what we're talking about with athleisure right now is the way that people have been like, I like feeling good in my body, and this makes me feel good, and my body is not the kind of body that Chip Wilson wanted to see in it. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, and I think also like a lot of people, I don't know, like I was looking at some stat about Hoka running shoes, about the percentage of people who do not wear them to run in, right? Like they just wear them because they're comfortable. And
I just wore them for a week at Disney.
Yeah. And like, great, you know, like wear something that is well-made and comfortable and that like makes it less likely that you're going to wreck your body. That's cool. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of people who wear this clothing, not because they want to be ready to go to a yoga class, but because mm-hmm. it feels good on their bodies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Totally.
Yeah. That ambivalent relationship to athleisure, I think, is in some ways a microcosm of our ambivalent relationship to leisure in general, which is that there are these histories, if we trace it back, to leisure that is actually about not working, that is actually about being comfortable, being at ease, doing nothing, having a sort of bodily and temporal freedom from labor and all of the things that it attaches to you. And for me, wearing like a bunch of stretchy clothes so that I can more comfortably contort myself on my sofa feels very physically liberating mm-hmm. in a way that has very little to do with optimization, unless I'm optimizing my couch pose.
I do think that the one like complication here, and this has to do with like our complicated relationship with leisure, especially I think as millennials who find it very difficult to not work, is that like maybe we just found a uniform that really does allow us to always be working, right? Mm-hmm. So that like, here's a uniform I can wear on a Zoom call that is also the uniform I can wear while checking emails, while laying on my couch, while watching Netflix, right? Like have a balance of work pervade everything that we do.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, not great.
Yeah. Oh, I disagree. I think it's great. I love how we can never stop working.
I do and I don't. I'm like, oh, yeah, like I can do the things that I want to do. Like, you know, like I always end up doing the things. But at the same time, I'm like, can you just stop? Like, just stop saying yes. Like, stop looking at your phone. Just
if you want to look at your phone less and in general think about work less, may I recommend 5 days at Disney with a high energy 8-year-old?
That is the thing. I was just talking earlier about how like concentrated time with kids as a non-child haver is a great way to not think about
work. Yeah. Yeah. And you know what's a really great thing to wear when you are hanging out with kids?
Athleisure.
Yeah, because they at any point might ask you to go on a slide.
or to lay on the ground and be the base of their airplane.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know how, like, in Mad Men, like, Betty was, like, never played with her kids, like, ever? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was because she was always freaking wearing a house dress, right? Like,
couldn't.
Who wants to play on the ground when you're wearing a house dress and your hair's
cut? She simply couldn't.
She's got a girdle on.
She was absolutely wearing a girdle.
That's right.
And that girdle might not even be made out of Lycra.
Ooh, it might have had, like, bones.
Yeah, 100% bones. Oh.
Okay, there's one last piece of this equation that I do want to touch on. And that is just because I want to bring the conversation back to how much I personally hate Chip Wilson. And that is Landmark Worldwide, the personal development company that is definitely not a cult. And like other things that are not a cult, has sued a lot of publications for calling it a cult. That's the top way you know something's not a cult, is it sued a bunch of people for calling it a cult. So scholars...
I feel like Scientology is also not a cult.
Not a cult, famously. Famously, you can tell because of all the lawsuits.
That's right.
So scholars call Landmark Worldwide an example of a corporate religion because it focuses on using self-improvement techniques to improve personal and employee productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And Chip Wilson loves it. He pays, like Lululemon pays for employees to attend Landmark Worldwide workshops. And it is fundamentally built into the ideology, values, and marketing discourse of the company, including those like famous bags.
The famous bags. I feel like they've moved away from the famous bags, but
It's
not a cult shit.
He also tried, as part of his funding, the new mayor of Vancouver. He tried to create a new policy where unhoused people, in order to access public resources, would have to attend a landmark worldwide weekend-long self-improvement training. No. So when we're talking about the degree to which this sort of fetishization of self-optimization has woven its way through our contemporary culture, you know, Lululemon becomes like a symptom rather than a cause, right?
Yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
leisure is just right. yet another outcropping of something much more insidious that is snaking through our politics and our social structures, as well as our, you know, internalized relationships to our bodies and our understandings of time. And I think it's useful to go back to what Marcel was saying about
Me?
The idea that we, yeah, Marcel, you, yeah, the idea that we take up the objects that we are presented with
mm-hmm.
and then figure out what to do with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that there is both profound value in historicizing these objects. I mean, I would say that's the whole premise of the podcast. But there is profound value in historicizing these objects. And then also recognizing that, like, well, it's the blocks that we have to play with. So what are we going to do with them, folks?
So, okay, I have to ask the two of you, because I am personally, I self-identify as a person who doesn't work. I have jobs. But I think I'm really good at not working, sometimes to my own detriment. And sort of in the same way that we're talking about athleisure as being something that we might be, it might be handed to us for one thing, but then we use it for these other things. I want to hear from the two of you about materialist critique, which is the sort of, you know, vegan bread and gluten-free butter of our show, and how it is that as millennials in the gig economy, it is that, you know, the two of you make it work for you. What do you do with it?
Yeah. And is this constant sort of critical engagement with the culture around us actually just an extension of our workaholism?
Yes. But I also, I don't know another way, right? Like, this is like, ever since, I guess, college, like just the idea that like, oh, there's something in front of me, I should think more about it. Like, it was at the heart of media studies. It was at the heart of cultural studies, which I didn't know what cultural studies were until I got into college. But it was, I had learned that in some way, that like you read a book, you watch a movie, you look at a movie star, like what else do you want to think about in terms of that? Like, what are they encouraging you to think about and interrogate in your world? And I also, like, I don't have a cultural studies mom or dad. Like, they're scientists, they're mathematicians. But I think that what they think is, like, you ask questions. Like, something happens and you ask questions. Even I used to be very involved in the Presbyterian Church, and, like, even that relationship was, like, you ask questions. And so I think that, like, when someone, and oftentimes it was a student, or it might be just like a reader who's like, isn't it exhausting to always be thinking about these things? Or like, what happens to your pleasure, right? Like, can you watch a movie for fun? And I'm like, absolutely. Right? Like, thinking is fun for me. I like it. And I just think that you can have those two things at once, right? Like, Laura Mulvey, the feminist theorist, famously said that, like, analysis essentially destroys pleasure. And she was talking about, like, male pleasure, the male gaze, and, like, how if you analyze the way that scopophilia, the pleasure in looking, works, then you can destroy some of that patriarchal pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
This is not that, right? Like, I can look at something like athleisure and be like, huh, like, every day I put it on and I think, like, something about it, like, how is it that they're engendering this desire for more sports bras? Like, why did I resist the Vuori jogger and now I have one? Like, what happened there? That's interesting, right? Like, all of that. What is going on with these weird words on this Lululemon bag? Yeah, it's just still like, that's why I write. I've always written because I felt like there were words exploding out of me. And I know not every writer has that relationship with writing. Like, the reason I started my newsletter was because there weren't enough opportunities for me to write about weird shit at BuzzFeed News. I was like, I have more things to say. I'll just keep writing this, right? Like, and that inadvertently, you know, wrote myself into my own job, my own newsletter, being my own boss. So I like that I get to be my own boss now and write about only the things that I think are interesting, not the things that other people think are interesting.
I was going through my head that whole time was that Simpsons line, iron helps us play. No, it's actually more fun when I work hard. But I really relate to that framing of sort of critical cultural analysis of like, mm-hmm. it's a form of attention. And for me, I think the best thing that we can do is pay attention. And there's mm-hmm. a lot of different forms that attention takes. And one of the really challenging things, you know, I think for a lot of us coming out of academia, but for lots of other folks as well, is to divorce the process of paying attention from the necessity to produce something out of that attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still trying to challenge myself to like have a thought and not turn it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What if I just mm-hmm. had a thought?
Or to get paid for it, right? To understand that if I do decide to do that I could get paid for it and I mm-hmm. should get paid for it.
Yeah.
A fair way.
Yeah.
That people will pay me money for it.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And that's also, you know, deeply entwined with the idea of like, well, if I'm going to use some of my time to think, that might as well be profitable.
Mm.
I have a different relationship to it as a salaried academic, because then it's like every thought that I ever have is me mm-hmm. yep. putting in more hours for the institution.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, no, it's complicated because like in that whole thing about getting paid too,
mm-hmm.
it's me unlearning the idea that I should do work for free. But then at the same time, I don't only want to do work when I am compensated for it. So how do you do those things at the same time, right?
Yeah.
How do you balance those compulsions? And I think for me, I've just had a lot of friends who have helped talk me through it and guide me through it.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, I come back to this impossibility of living outside of ideology, right? This is it's Althusser. Yeah. He's like, there is no outside to ideology. Like, we can stand inside capitalism and critique it, and actually we need to. That's really, really vital. But we can't stand outside of capitalism and critique it. We're right in the thick of it.
No, no.
We're interpolated.
Interpolated. Marcel, are you
interpolated?
I'm absolutely interpolated. I'm absolutely not outside of this ideology. I'm just a sleepy guy.
God, I'm gonna make us all like baseball hats that just say interpolated.
I pulled that one out. I haven't used that one in a while.
I'm impressed. Really impressed.
It's just a quiver.
Material Girls is a Witch Please production and is distributed by Acast. Why don't you slip into some quick, drying, moisture-wicking, silver-infused yoga pants and head on over to awitchplease.ca to check out the rest of our episodes, as well as transcripts, reading lists, and merch. We don't have any athleisure yet, but we will. I mean, we do have t-shirts and sweatshirts.
We've got hoodies. That's athleisure.
We got hoodies. We have an excellent newsletter at substack.com/awitchplease and an even better Patreon at patreon.com/awitchplease. Also, we're on Instagram, X, and Threads at @OWitchPlease, and on TikTok at @OWitchPleasePod. And what are some of the websites where people can find more about you and your work?
Culture Study is at annhelen.substack.com, and then the Culture Study Pod, which you can find at culturestudypod@substack.com. If you just Google, you can find both of those things. And then I'm on Instagram at annhelenpeterson.
Beautifully streamlined online presence.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Auto Syndicate for the use of our theme song, Shopping Mall. And of course, thanks to the whole Witch Please Productions team, our digital content coordinator, Gabby Iori, our social media manager and marketing designer, Zoe Mix. Our sound engineer, Malika Gampankam. Our transcriber, Ruth Ormiston. And our executive producer, Hannah Rehack, a.k.a. Coach.
At the end of every episode, we will thank everyone who has joined our Patreon or boosted their tier to help make our work possible. Our enormous gratitude goes out to Brandice R.,
For Fox's Sake, Kathy Y, Afton P, Sarah B, Amelia Y, Three Queers in a Trench Coat. Holy moly, thank you all.
We'll be back next episode to tackle another piece of pop culture through a whole new theoretical lens. But until then...
later, optimizators.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.